Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, the first part of a two-part conversation with composer John Adams about his concerts with the San Francisco Symphony in celebration of his 70th birthday. Comedian Alicia Dattner tells us about her one-woman show at the Marsh in Berkeley called Eat, Pray, Laugh. Plus, you'll hear about the Bernal Hill Players CD release and upcoming concert, as well as the concert offerings this season from Chamber Music San Francisco, from the director of that series, Daniel Levenstein. Also on the music front, organist Paul Vasile and Lisa Bialawa, artistic director of the San Francisco Girls Chorus, share details about their upcoming concerts. Stay with us. The Bernal Hill Players are doing their part for U.S.-Mexico relations by offering a concert this Sunday afternoon as part of the Old First Church concert series, coinciding with their CD release, Neighborhoods of Mexico City. Here to talk about that is flutist Marta Rodriguez Salazar and pianist Jennifer Perringer. Singer, flutist, conductor, and producer Marta Rodriguez Salazar has been bringing Latin American folk, classical, and contemporary music to the Bay Area for more than 15 years. For her outstanding leadership in promoting and developing Mexican music and culture in the Bay Area, Marta was recognized as a luminary in 2011 by the Mexican Consulate in San Francisco and as Excelencia Latina by LAM and Mundo Fox in 2013. She's a native of Mexico City, classically trained in both Mexico and at Mills College as a concert flutist and opera singer. She currently performs with the Bernal Hill Players and the Latin folk duo Chile y Limón, which is herself with my other guest, Jennifer Perringer, as well as curating the Dia de los Muertos event at the San Francisco Symphony, directing the annual Mexican Christmas musical theater show La Pasarela, and conducting several other adult community choirs. Marta is on the faculty of the Community Music Center here in San Francisco, where she coordinates a musical scholarship program for local Latino youth. Marta, welcome back to Open Air.
Hello, David. Thank you so much for your invitation.
Happy to have you. She's joined by Jennifer Perringer, who's a pianist who is passionate about playing chamber music from around the world with specialties in Latin American repertoire and newly composed music. She's a founding member of the Bernal Hill Players, for whom she has made numerous innovative arrangements of works by composers such as Manuel de Falla, Agustin Lara, Astor Piazzolla, and Carlos Santana. She also performs with Katrina Reed's Composing Together Ensemble. Her eclectic background includes a decade spent in London playing saxophone, congas, tablas, keyboards, and accordion in various bands and theater companies before going on to earn music degrees from the University of London and San Francisco State University. She also teaches at the Community Center here in San Francisco. Welcome to you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you. I'm having a little bit of problems with some miking here, so I'm going to hopefully that will correct itself. The project is called SFDF, Music of Two Cities, and has involved composers from both San Francisco and Mexico City to write pieces inspired by neighborhoods of their cities. Is DF another name for Mexico City?
In fact, DF was the name of Distrito Federal that was what Ciudad de Mexico now is the way to call it. In fact, now DF is defunct. It's called Distrito Federal before, now it's Mexico City.
And when did this project start for you?
It started in 2010, and we started by commissioning a couple of composers who teach at the Community Music Center with us from San Francisco. Initially, we thought we would like to create a series of pieces by local composers based on the theme of in and about San Francisco. People, each composer chose a neighborhood from the city to write about. So it started with San Francisco, and then it migrated to Mexico City.
I'm going to have you guys move into another studio. We're going to play some music as we make that transition. We were going to go out with this music, but let's hear this music now as we get you resituated and we can hear a little bit better.
Oh, cool. Let's do that.
What are we going to hear?
Trompo. Okay, so we're going to be listening to composer Eduardo Gamboa's work that we commissioned in 2012. It's called Miss Quack, and it's the last movement called Trompo.
Then more with the Bernal Hill Players. From the Bernal Hill Players here as my guests in open air on KALW San Francisco. I think we have you ladies now in a better miking situation. Is that right?
I think so. Can you hear us?
I can now.
Oh, wonderful.
We're in that transition stage of moving back into our Burton High School digs, and some of the technical difficulties are bound to be moving ahead as well. We'll get those things straightened out, but now we can actually have a conversation, and the people on the other side of the microphone and radio land can hear you a little bit better.
Great.
Here with Marta Rodriguez-Salazar and Jennifer Perringer to talk about the Bernal Hill Players' upcoming concert at the Old First Concerts series this coming Sunday, the 26th at 4 p.m. Great, fun music. Is that, where are you finding this music?
Well, we came up with the idea that we explore the whole classical world and contemporary composers, but we always found that we couldn't find the right combination for our instruments. We have flute, clarinet, cello, piano, some percussion. So we ended up saying, well, why don't we just commission composers? It's going to be a great way to expand their repertoire, to also connect with great musicians out there. And so what we do is, like, we connect with people we know, then recommendations of music that we like, and we say, hey, we approach them and we say, we would love if you can compose a song for us, a piece for us, with this topic, this theme, which has to do with neighborhoods of both cities.
Did this idea of the neighborhoods of both cities, it had to have come into being well before the current political situation?
Yes, but it's very apropos to what's going on now. We didn't realize when we started the project just how socially relevant it would be by the time it was finished. In the current political climate, more than ever, we need to assert the importance of multiculturalism in the United States and celebrate the incredible cultural gifts which our successive generations of immigrants have brought to this country, in particular here in San Francisco, which has such deep cultural connections to Mexico.
Tell us a little bit about the other members of Bernal Hill Players. Jennifer.
We'll be playing the concert on Sunday with Rachel Condry, a wonderful clarinetist who also teaches at the Community Music Center. And Rachel has, she's at Mills College. She's just finished a master's at Mills College. She's very involved with contemporary music and improvisation. And she's a wonderful, enthusiastic person to be playing with.
And also we are performing with a cellist from the San Francisco Symphony, Jill Brindell, who has played with us. And so not only she's a wonderful cellist, she's a wonderful friend as well. So it's a pleasure to be able to do chamber music with people we love and we enjoy.
How are you managing to fund these concerts?
Well, that's a good question you had there. This is a project of love. I mean, we applied for grants. We were part of the San Francisco Friends of Chamber Music, and we had applied for the Community Music Center's funding for composing as well. But I mean, and also a lot of private donors. But that's usually the struggle. The struggle is to let people know who we are and also to apply for grants and get money, especially, you know, what we wanted to do, which we haven't been able to, is to bring our music to Mexico. But it's been hard to find funding to do that. It's a struggle, but we can do this.
And it's so important right now, especially on this topic. More power to you, my gosh. And once we do have our studio settled, we're going to invite you back for a live performance, which we have a little bit more space for. But in the meantime, in addition to the two CDs that are available at BernalHillPlayers.com, we're going to go out with some more music that I believe is going to be performed on this coming Sunday at 4 o'clock. It's called Tepito. Tell me about what that work is.
Oh, yeah. Jennifer. It's been very exciting working. It's by a prominent composer in Mexico City. Her name is Gabriela Ortiz. And she belonged to a family which she grew up with Mexican folk music and then went on to study classical composition in Paris and in London. And she became the head of the composition department in Mexico City. The Tepito is a piece, it's a neighborhood in Mexico City, a sort of vibrant and edgy working class neighborhood. And she wrote this piece in five parts. And the part you're going to hear is called Calzado Pachuco. Maybe you can explain what Calzado Pachuco
is. Which is dancing, danzón dancing. They have really these shiny shoes, red, blue, orange. And so you're going to go immersed into that culture of Tepito with this music you're going to be hearing.
Very nice. Marta Rodriguez-Salazar, Jennifer Perringer, thank you so much for coming in today. And we look forward to the concert on Sunday.
Thank you.
Here is Tepito, the Bernal Hill Players. Again, more information for their concert at BernalHillPlayers.com this Sunday at 4. Of Gabriela Ortiz, which you can hear this Sunday, performed by the Bernal Hill Players. The concert at Old First Church in San Francisco here is this coming Sunday at 4 p.m. Information at oldfirstconcerts.org and more about the Bernal Hill Players at bernalhillplayers.com. Organist Paul Vasile will be guest collaborating artist this weekend for concerts with the San Francisco Girls Chorus at Mission Dolores here in San Francisco and First Presbyterian in Oakland. The concert is entitled Out of Darkness and will feature the chorus singing music by Brahms, Mendelssohn, Poulenc, Grieg, and Arvo Pärt. Paul Vasile and the artistic director of the chorus, Lisa Bielawa, join me in studio to talk about those concerts. Paul Vasile is a pianist, organist, and conductor based in New York City. He performs as a soloist and collaborative artist both nationally and internationally. With a strong interest in contemporary music, it's led to premieres of new piano, organ, and choral works by a number of composers, including Lisa Bielawa. In addition to being collaborative artist with the chorus, Paul will also perform Herbert Howell's rarely performed Psalm Prelude Opus 32, number 1 for solo organ. Paul, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
And welcome to this half of the country for a little visit, I imagine. Always a pleasure to welcome Lisa Bielawa back to our studios, not wearing her composer hat, but instead her artistic director of the San Francisco Girls Chorus hat. Lisa, welcome back to
Open
Air.
Thanks so much, David. Great to be here, as always.
Of course. Well, this is quite a concert coming up. Out of Darkness. Let's first of all talk about the title, if you would, Lisa.
Sure. Well, you know, I this all started because we were thinking about the Lenten season, of course, is in the Christian calendar, and looking at some of the settings of the Psalms, the Psalm texts, which are often show some of the darker sides of faith. You often find the protagonist crying out, you know, Lord, where are you? You know, why can't I feel your presence? You know, these kinds of...
Where were you in November?
Right. For example, maybe this was the inspiration for it all. But it's also the source, you know, this kind of motivating sentiment for these works is also there's a broad expressive range and the repertoire that we're doing this weekend really has a kind of a very sort of emotionally sophisticated palette.
Speaking of that, it's the sophisticated nature. These are some significant pieces that the chorus has tackled.
Yes, this is repertoire that is largely written for women. Women's voices, women's choruses. You know, Brahms founded women's choruses, and a lot of these works were. These are not treble works for children. These are pieces that are designed to be performed by performers who have at their artistic fingertips the whole range of human emotion and expression. So yes, it has that breadth and depth to it.
And how did you, as artistic director, how did you choose these specific works and know that the chorus was ready for them?
Well, you know, as you may know, I was in the San Francisco Girls Chorus when I was growing up here in San Francisco, and I had the honor and pleasure of singing under the founder, Elizabeth Appling. And so there are pieces on most of the pieces on this concert, actually. I sang myself under the direction of Elizabeth Appling. She was very ambitious about the expressive range of the group, and she came from an opera background, something that she has in common with our current music director, Valerie Saint-Agathe, not primarily from a choral background, but from an opera background. And so I felt, after working for several years together with Valerie Saint-Agathe, I really felt like it was time for us to go back and revisit some of this repertoire that had been sort of initiating repertoire for me into the sound of women's voices singing together.
And how did the chorus find Paul Vasile?
Well, I guess that would be through me, but Paul is a good friend of the chorus now. He actually had a really unique role in our season last year because he was able, on both coasts, because he's bicoastal, sort of like me, he was able to help the girls prepare the repertoire that they put together for the New York Philharmonic Biennial last year. So he was rehearsal pianist for a lot of very ambitious repertoire, including a piece of my own that they tackled. So Paul was part of of that, and then when we gave a chamber performance of that music at our closing season concert last year, he was on stage at the Conservatory of Music with the girls. So he knows them well, and I knew that they would be able to sort of climb this mountain together, that they have that trust already together. They hadn't yet heard him play the organ, and of course he's going to be playing one of the biggest organs in the Bay Area on Sunday, so that's magnificent.
Let's talk a little bit, Paul, about how you get ready to perform on such an instrument that's at Mission Dolores and at First Presbyterian.
It's interesting. You know, organs are very, I won't say organists can be proprietary. you know, when you are hired as a church musician, you have the luxury of being in a space and having an instrument to play. And so I find that as a guest organist coming into a church, I have to contact the church ahead of time and the music director and sort of find odd and unused hours when the church is not being used. So I was up at 8 o'clock this morning to go to Mission Dolores to meet the wonderful organist, Jerome, and to be welcomed into that space to see the instrument. I'll go back after this interview to do more registering and to make sure that I'm ready. I find that the organ requires a very meticulous approach. You have to know where you're going and when. You have to be very flexible, but you have to have a sense of order. In a concert like this, especially where there is a lot of beautiful color in this repertoire, the organ, of course, is an accompanying instrument, but it has always, there's an ear, knowing the girls, knowing the sound, knowing the musicianship of this group, trying to find the right sounds to complement and to enrich what they're offering in terms of the texts.
You have an ongoing relationship with the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, where you get a chance to play on some of the historic instruments in their instrument collection. What has that been like? And then tell me about one of the favorite organs that you've played on anywhere in the world.
Yeah, the Metropolitan Museum of Art has been a wonderful opportunity. I have played several solo recitals on a really small but little powerful instrument that was built in the mid-1800s, and it was found untouched in a church in Connecticut. They brought it to the museum, and now they offer midday or midweek recitals on it, and I've played three now. It honestly is such a unique experience to play an instrument that has been in existence. Is the instrument itself is almost 175 years old. Organs are like that. And that actually, I think, relates to one of my favorite experiences. I was invited to play an organ festival in Riga, Latvia, back in 2013, and played what at one time was one of the largest pipe organs in the world. And honestly, the experience of the organ for me is not just size and immensity, but color and variety. And that instrument in particular in the Riga Dome had such an incredible richness in colors, from the roaring reeds, you know, deep 32-foot shake the rafter sort of sounds, to the most delicate and warm, lush tones. And that's, for me, the fun and the joy of the organ as opposed to the piano and to other music that I am involved in is the range of colors and the kaleidoscope of that particular.
And you've chosen a solo work by Herbert Howells. Is that going to help exploit the positive energy, the positive characteristics of the organs that you're going to be playing?
Absolutely. And that was the intention in this choice. It's Herbert Howells wrote two sets of psalm preludes, and they're not well known, maybe not well enough known, and they're each based on a psalm verse that he sort of gives almost a, I don't know how to say it. It's program music in a way. And so this exploits the instrument from the very softest whispers to the roar. And it's depicting the cry of the soul. This poor man cried out to the Lord is the text. And you'll literally hear the organ go from sort of this quiet and reflective interior space to a churning and then to a real eruption. It's like a Debussy sunken cathedral sort of experience. But when the 32-foot pipes go on, especially in Oakland, you'll know. the building shakes.
Out of Darkness, the concert with the San Francisco Girls Chorus with guest collaborating artist Paul Vasile on organ is Saturday, this Saturday at 8 at Mission Dolores, Sunday the 26th at 4 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church in Oakland. And Lisa, I understand that there's a future collaboration coming up for the Duraflay Requiem with the Golden Gate Men's Chorus.
That's right. It's That's going to be a great pleasure to have that partnership. And I'm actually especially looking forward to something that is going to be really fun for us. Their conductor will be conducting the girls, and Valerie's going to get a chance to conduct the men. And so this is sort of a playful exchange of kind of conductors. A conductor's exchange is something I'm really interested in.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And we'll look forward to hearing them perhaps when that concert rolls around.
Yeah.
sfgirlschorus.org for all things considered and the girls' chorus. And for tickets for this weekend's concerts, visit City Box Office. Thanks so much for coming in. We're going to hear a little bit of the Mendelssohn that you actually were participating
in. That's right.
In,
this is a 1983 performance from Grace Cathedral, the San Francisco Girls Chorus under Elizabeth Appling's leadership. And I'm in the first alto section, and my mother is playing the organ. So.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Music from Mendelssohn's Three Motets, part of the concert this coming weekend of the San Francisco Girls Chorus. Music to also include music by Francis Poulenc, Johannes Brahms, Edvard Grieg, Arvo Pärt, and a solo piece by guest organist Paul Vasile by Herbert Howells. Well, America's most celebrated composer, John Adams, has been enjoying worldwide accolades in celebration of his 70th birthday, including concerts this week and last with the San Francisco Symphony. I caught up with him after yesterday's rehearsal of Scheherazade Point Two, his work, at Davies Symphony Hall. Here's the first part of that conversation. John Adams, such a pleasure to finally have a chance to talk with you on open air.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So how did this morning's rehearsal go?
Well, you know, it's I think people who go to classical music concerts would probably be surprised, you know, how limited the rehearsal time is. You know, a piece like mine, there are nearly 100 people on stage, so there's very, very limited time, and the conductor has to judge what is you know, what's going to survive on its own, and what, if it isn't rehearsed, is never going to get better.
Have you found that you're hearing different sounds coming out of the various orchestras and conductors that have been performing Scheherazade, and is that influencing you in any way?
Well, you know, I stay in pretty good touch with almost all of my pieces, largely through conducting them myself, and I actually have not sat in the audience since the world premiere, which was, 2 years ago, with Alan Gilbert and the New York Philharmonic. Every other time, I've been conducting it myself, so it was a very different experience to be out a little further back, and of course, you know, I can't fix things myself. I have to rely on finding the right moment to go up to the conductor and say something. So, performing is it's the other half of the creative act, and I think that I would prefer to be on the podium. But this week, since it was my birthday week, I just wanted to relax and let somebody else do the driving.
Well, indeed, celebrations abound for this, your 70th birthday year, just last week, in fact. Sorry I missed the birthday cake, and happy birthday to you. Interesting anniversary year, though. It's also Ten Dunn's 60th birthday year. Philip Glass is 80. Conductor laureate of the symphony here, Herbert Blomstedt, is 90. And, of course, Lou Harrison's 100th
continues to be celebrated, most notably with last Saturday's Other Minds concert at Mission Dolores. The only A-list classical name I could come up with a 50th birthday is Joshua Bell, so I don't know if he's doing any composing yet, but nonetheless. But Mason Bates just celebrated 40 last month, and your own soloist for Scheherazade, Leila Josefowicz, will have her 40th in October. Another significant anniversary I noticed this year dates from 1987. It's now the 30th anniversary of the premiere of Nixon in China at Houston Grand Opera, later going to the Met in 2011. Did you ever, in your wildest imaginings, think you'd be nostalgic for the Nixon administration, given the bizarre national happenings of the last several months?
Well, I can feel what way this conversation's going, and I'm not interested. But I'm very proud of Nixon in China, and in fact, I'm, as soon as I leave San Francisco here on Saturday, I'm going to go down to Los Angeles and conduct a semi-stage performance with the L.A. Philharmonic. So I come back to the piece every so often. The last time I did it, we did it at a proms in London, and right before that, of course, we did a run at the Metropolitan Opera. So I never would have thought when I was composing it, my first opera, you know, very inexperienced stage composer, that this would become a near repertoire item.
Last week we were treated here in San Francisco to performances of the Gospel According to the Other Mary with guest conductor Grant Gershon. This week's performance is here with the San Francisco Symphony, home turf for you, with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting your Scheherazade. Specific choices of yours to present works that give voice to women fighting for self-realization instead of, say, as you mentioned, the best of John Adams?
Well, it's sort of a coincidence. I mean, I'm certainly not, trying to assign myself some, you know, social or political point of view, but it is interesting that these two works focus on women trying to find self-realization, and I think, this has been something that we've been intensely aware of in the news, whether it's been women being oppressed or abused or made fun of, it could be in the Middle East or Afghanistan or Pakistan, but of course we saw that right here in our own presidential campaign. But also just, from the point of view of a creative artist, that female energy, which is both expressive and tender and capable of great power, that's really something that, we artists are drawn to. Think of all the paintings and the statues of women throughout the ages. And in the case of Scheherazade Point Two, I was inspired by an exhibition that I saw in Paris of the history of Scheherazade through the ages. And I came back and I got out to Arabian Nights and started reading and realized how horrible the story of Scheherazade was, and Rimsky-Korsakov just kind of floats right through that. So I wanted to make a Scheherazade that really was fighting back from oppression. So my piece, which is, I call it a dramatic symphony, which is a term borrowed from Berlioz, but it's essentially a concerto on a very large scale that also is a bit of a kind of a narrative.
Of course, a violin is the prominent soloist in that other Scheherazade of Rimsky-Korsakov. Inevitable, I suppose, to have that work in mind. But unlike Rimsky-Korsakov, you're saying there's not a specific storyline or plot, but descriptive movement titles nonetheless. The first movement, Tales of the Wise Young Woman, and then Pursuit by True Believers. Two, A Long Desire, which is the love scene, beautiful writing. And three, Scheherazade and the Men with Beards. And fourth and final movement, Escape, Flight, Sanctuary. As you mentioned, a lot of this could be pulled from today's headlines.
Yes, it could. I try to make pieces that, engage our lives. You know, I wrote operas about terrorism, which is the death of Klinghoffer, or the atomic bomb, Dr. Atomic, or in the case of Nixon in China, it's not only about the clash of very egotistical world leaders, but also about the clash of communism versus capitalism. So these are themes that I think are deeply in the collective psyche, and certainly women struggling for self-realization is important. And I don't think it's a subject that only women themselves can address. I think men have a right to address that, because we are, you know, in a sense, we're trying to go there. We're trying to find our own sense of self-realization and in relationship to women's struggle.
After hearing part of the rehearsal and hearing the recording that was made with the Mr. Maestro Robertson, I think it's pretty important that the listening audience has these descriptive titles in mind while listening. Does it bother you that maybe a good deal of the audience may not have read the descriptive movements and may miss what you're trying to communicate?
Well, it is a problem, and it's a challenge. But any challenging and meaningful work of art requires preparation. I mean, who reads Shakespeare without reading the footnotes? You just can't take it in. And, you know, the more complicated works by Beethoven and Mahler, we hear them over and over again, but we learn what they're about. We learn them about the life of the composer, and it takes familiarity. You know, when I conduct the piece, Scheherazade Point Two, I usually say a few words to the audience about it. Hopefully MTT will do that tonight.
Well, comparing again to the Rimsky-Korsakov, who won as a musician or a lay listener, just revels in the orchestration. He literally wrote one of the books, after all. Your use of the cymbalum in Scheherazade, also quite prominent in the Gospel According to the Other Mary. Now, for our lay listeners, let's perhaps give a description of the cymbalum and how you're using it, along with a wide variety of tuned gongs. Why?
Well, these are instruments that don't usually feature in the standard classical orchestra. I don't know why the orchestra became such a kind of fixed entity. It was just kind of a strange evolutionary fluke that you'd have, you know, two oboes and two flutes and one piccolo and four horns and so many strings, and not, for example, a bass guitar, which I use, not always, but it's a wonderful sound. The cymbalom is a Hungarian folk instrument. It's, I guess if you could imagine the inside of a piano being played with a set of beaters that look a little bit like chopsticks, that's what it looks like. But the tuning is a little on the sour side, and I love that sound because it has it's unique. It kind of jumps out of the orchestra, and it has a sort of, a sweet and sour tang to it. And the gongs are they all come from Thailand. I think they were developed for folk music, certainly used a great deal in Balinese music, and they have this wonderful pure pitch with a very long tail, long resonant, and I've been using them for 15 years in my music, and I love them.
Well, let's hear a part of the beautiful opening movement of Scheherazade Point Two, as performed by violinist Leila Josefowicz and the St. Louis Symphony, conducted by David Robertson.
Thank you.
the opening of John Adams' Scheherazade Point Two. Violinist Leila Josefowitz will have the remaining performances tomorrow evening, this evening, and Saturday at 8 p.m. Remaining performances of John Adams' Scheherazade Point Two. Tickets and information at sfsymphony.org. And next week, more of my conversation with John Adams at Davies Symphony Hall. That's the great Pinchas Zukerman performing Beethoven. That composer and performer represented on the upcoming concerts of Chamber Music San Francisco. A pleasure to welcome back Daniel Levenstein, that organization's director, to talk about this season's offerings. In particular, Pinchas Zukerman's upcoming appearances in San Francisco, Walnut Creek, and Palo Alto, February 25th to the 27th. Prior to his work shepherding Chamber Music San Francisco into existence in 2003, Daniel co-founded the Smuin Ballet with Michael Smuin and served as its executive director and acted as its music director for some of those years. In addition to producing a wide variety of shows for arts organizations around the Bay Area, Daniel was associate musical director of Beach Blanket Babylon for some 13 years. Welcome back to Open Air, Daniel.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, Chamber Music San Francisco's season is well underway with Olga Kern recently having done some concerts after Mr. Zukerman, the other great violinist on your series, Augustin Hadelik, is coming in. But Pinchas Zukerman, I had the pleasure of talking with him a couple of times when he was in town back in 2012 when he performed with the San Francisco Symphony and then last year when he was back for that. Congratulations on getting him for the series.
Thank you. It's a real coup for us. I've been a fan of his since I was a conservatory student here at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. I remember vividly playing his Bach concertos and his Brahms sonatas on vinyl, if you remember vinyl. And so when we started this current organization 14 years ago, he was always in my mind, and it's enormously satisfying to actually have him on stage.
Your approach for Chamber Music San Francisco is a little bit different than other ensembles, more of a traditional approach and settings that are a little bit more intimate than the larger halls.
Well, yes, this sort of music, chamber music, by its nature, is suited to chambers. What a concept. And, in my experience, my checkered past, I have found that you have to have a certain level of quality and theatricality to engage the audience. And the beauty of this organization and this art form is that it's possible to give the highest quality musical experience with very few people. My previous organization, Smuin Ballets, you had to go through many dollars and many broken bones and many and much politics to get anything on the stage, whereas this is very simple. You have these wonderful artists. They come to town, they set up, they play, and they leave. Life can be easy.
Well, like the Smuin Ballet, cornerstone of Chamber Music San Francisco is having the same concerts done in different venues in different towns.
That's correct. Actually, it's more important for us than Smuin Ballets, to my understanding. It's really core to who we are. We have concerts in San Francisco, Walnut Creek, and Palo Alto. We're the only organization, not only in the country, but in the world, to have a partnership between three cities like this, and sharing expenses helps the artists because they get a nice fee. They get to stay in one hotel, which is in San Francisco, not too onerous, and they get appreciative audiences. The organization likes it because we're fulfilling our mission in a very efficient fashion, and the greatest beneficiaries are the audiences, especially in the suburbs. San Francisco is saturated with great artists, but not so much in Walnut Creek and Palo Alto. So we have a 5-concert series in those two communities in the suburbs, and they're completely sold out in the 300-seat halls on subscription. People buy the 5-concert package, and that means that gives me liberty to bring in artists who are not well known. I go to Europe every year to scout them, and I bring back the creme de la creme, pardon my French, and even if they don't sell very well in San Francisco, they are much appreciated in the suburbs, and that makes the whole thing work.
How are you finding the audiences differing in the three cities that you're presenting in?
Well, they each have their own character. Walnut Creek, I would say they are the least, quote, educated, unquote. I mean, there's a certain percentage of every audience that is well-versed in music. I mean, there are many of my patrons who are more knowledgeable than I am. I mean, my job is not to be the most knowledgeable in the room. It's to be a producer and an impresario. However, they are the warmest of the three. I will say that. They are very enthusiastic. We're the only game in town in Contra Costa County for presenting music at this level. So that's a great pleasure. Palo Alto is the most sophisticated audience because, you know, you've got all the brainy people down there in Silicon Valley and Stanford University. They are a little bit spoiled for choice because they can drive an hour up to the city. They have Stanford. They have a wonderful summer festival there. They're not quite as hungry for what we offer, but they are very appreciative that we're bringing it to their doorsteps. San Francisco, of course, is the most challenging because there is so much happening in the city itself. It is saturated with excellent offerings. I think that we have a distinctive character to what we do, and we do have a following. There are people that subscribe to all of our concerts in the city, all 9 concerts, and they usually do so on our website, www.chambermusicsf.org. And they come back year after year. Because of my checkered past, I do have a theatrical bent, and that is emphasized on stage.
Well, the Bay Area seems to have such a healthy appetite for chamber music. It's wonderful that these ensembles can be sustained and thriving in such a wonderful atmosphere and environment. Now, as the success of not only Chamber Music San Francisco seems to grow, as well as other esteemed ensembles seem to prove, you've mentioned a major uptick in online listening as well.
Well, that is my impression. I mean, the attendance for live performances, frankly, is a challenge all over the country in this field for classical music. However, there is a ray of sunshine. It is my understanding that interest in classical music online in terms of streaming and downloads and YouTube views is actually on the increase. So, I mean, rather than 5% of activity, it might be 8%, but that's significant. And so I think that our challenge in the art management field is to inspire people who are online to give it a try live because it's better.
You seem to have a more of a traditional approach to the traditional classical repertoire. I don't want to say it's more meat and potatoes. It's comfort food, but it's far from trifling. It's got all of the major elements to introduce people to the great classics.
Well, this is our mission. There are other organizations that have different missions, but this is what I like, is to connect with audiences with the quality music that they love. And, you know, we introduce some I have 3 constituencies. If I make the 3 of them happy, which are the audience, the performers, and the supporters, then I'm doing my job. And so the artists want to play new music, and so we kind of judiciously, we negotiate and mix that in. But my supporters and my audience do not have a big appetite for contemporary music. So, you know, I am here to serve. I mean, another example of an organization would be the Contemporary Music Players, excellent organization, known them for decades, and they do great work. I believe, I'm not talking out of school here, that about 90% of their operating income comes from donations and only 10% from ticket sales. And I prefer, just as a personal preference, to be doing things that attract ticket buyers. That's just more fun for me. So, our ratio is more like 40% of ticket income and 60% earned. And I like it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're a proud papa to, fathering this year's season. In addition to Binka Zuckerman, can you point out a favorite or someone that you're proud of having a part of this particular season of Chamber Music San Francisco?
Well, the next artist after Binka Zuckerman is Augustine Hadelick, who won the Grammy last year for Best Classical Instrumental Solo, and he is wonderful. This is the second time we're having him, and we're proud to have that relationship. We're also giving the San Francisco recital debut of Jean-Aflame Bavouze, who gave his San Francisco debut last year, and he's a wonderful, charming individual on stage. And when you book an artist, you need to match them with a repertoire that they're best at. And for him, Haydn, early Beethoven, and Debussy and Ravel are his strong suits. So it says in the contract that that's what he's going to play. But speaking of new music, what will often happen in that circumstance is that, for example, a pianist who's fabulous at Chopin, for their own personal growth, wants to play Beethoven. And so they offer, they propose a program of Beethoven, but I say, no, not so much. We want to hear what you're really, really good at. It's the same in every aspect of the performing arts. You know, rock bands, the audiences want to hear their greatest hits. They don't want to hear the latest album. So everything's a negotiation, the art of the deal in music. And at the end of the day, we have these wonderful performers on stage and happy audiences. Who could ask for anything more?
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like the 2018 season is already booked with violinists James Ennis and Midori already scheduled. Are you scheduling beyond that? Are you looking forward to this coming summer to exploring Europe and enticing some folks for the 1920 season?
Well, all of the above. I'm pretty much done with 2019, the year after this coming. I can't reveal the artists, though. But what's interesting is that because 2020 is a Beethoven year, it's the 250th anniversary of his birth, everybody will be clamoring for Beethoven. And so you want to get a jump on the other presenters around the world and kind of nab the best Beethoven string quartets and the best pianists, etc. Actually, I was talking to the manager of a Beethoven specialist pianist, and I said, we're interested in talking to you about this artist for the Beethoven anniversary. And she said, well, first of all, it's the Beethoven Jubilee. And what I realized is that Jubilee is just like anniversary, except more expensive.
Good point. Concerts with Binka Zuckerman are in San Francisco on Saturday the 25th at 8 at the Herbst, Sunday at 3 in Walnut Creek, and Monday the 27th in Palo Alto. Information at chambermusicsf.org. Daniel, thanks for taking some time today.
Thanks for having me.
And speaking of Beethoven, let's hear more from Binka Zuckerman and Ludwig van. Also from the Sonata No. 5, Opus 24, the Frühling Sonata, or Spring Sonata, here's the first movement. That's the great Binka Zuckerman performing Beethoven. My next guest, Alicia Dattner, was voted Best Comedian in both the San Francisco Weekly and San Francisco Bay Guardian, and has performed in Hollywood, Hawaii, Bali, New York, Bombay, and London, among other cities and venues. In her solo show, Eat, Pray, Laugh, Alicia leaves the safety of her identity as a comedian in San Francisco for a 3-month solo adventure across India. Alicia started dreaming of being a comedian at the ripe old age of 8 and did her first set at the age of 18. Since then, being mentored by several talented comedians over the years, including W. Kamau Bell, Eugene Merman, and Bill Santiago, she's been killing audiences, well, maybe not literally, at clubs like The Improv and Gotham Comedy Club in San Francisco, New York, Hollywood, and around the world. She also offers one-on-one comedy coachings, as well as storytelling and stand-up workshops. Alicia, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks, David.
So, was there some sort of a personal revelation or trauma, a special birthday maybe, that inspired you to take this trip?
Lots of trauma, I think. You know, low-level ongoing trauma of not becoming the big, shiny success that I thought I would or that I'd hoped, and soul-searching, looking into what's not working here.
So why India?
I hadn't really thought of it ever until one day someone mentioned it to me and just said, oh, you might, you know, if you really want something big and life-changing, check out India.
And why solo? I mean, it's part of the subtitle of the quotes from your website on this show is Jewish Princess Seeks Indian Guru for One Life Stand. Was that part of your motivation as well?
I just think it's funny. I mean, I just love, you know, the search for someone who knows the answers, I think, is pretty deep in me. Someone who gets it better or who could see me better than I could see myself. And no, I don't think I expected to find the guru, but I think I hoped to find wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Was this trip more spontaneous or meticulously planned?
I wanted to have a complete spontaneous adventure. So I got the book, the, you know, Lonely Planet, and I'm looking at the entire map of India, and I'm researching and I'm reading the whole thing. And then I just decided I don't want to have a plan. I want to see what happens. So totally spontaneous. I booked my first 10-day Vipassana meditation course when I arrived. And from there, I just kind of figured it out day by day.
Wow, that's ambitious as well as courageous, I think. What happened along the way that you didn't expect?
Oh, that's a good question. People were so generous and so interested in connecting, and it didn't occur to me, I think, how many people there would be and how much contact and interaction there would be and how, you know, at one moment someone would be kind of trying to pull a scam or I wouldn't be sure what was happening. And then at another moment, someone else would be looking out for me and taking care of me and guiding me to the next right place. And it was just constant input.
Strongest memory.
There's a moment when I come to this town, Tiruvannamalai, and I somehow get invited to a musical gathering. There's this music called kirtan, which is call and response singing. And we're just all singing, and it's like it's a wave of just ease and peace wash over me being surrounded by these other people just singing. And, you know, in those moments, those peak moments when it's just like, oh, everything is beautiful.
Speaking of music, renowned musician Mirabai Wolkowitz?
Wolkowitz
will be opening the show and setting the stage. Tell us about the music of Mirabai.
She is a dear friend of mine, and she has been studying jazz and classical music, and now this kirtan music. She's also a yoga teacher, so she's going to India, and she's bringing the chanting, this Sanskrit chanting. And she's also a dear friend of mine, and I just love her so much. And you can just feel her heart and her both profound way of, like, walking in the world as a person who wants to, you know, be good and be conscientious, and also her playfulness and fun. And I think that all just comes through when she's singing. And we're all singing together, and it's kind of like that moment that I had in India.
Very nice. So this trip was all about self-discovery. What did you ultimately discover?
I didn't need to go to India. It's all right here.
So are you? Do you consider yourself fulfilled now, or can we expect another three-month hiatus in your schedule for more self-revelation?
Yes. both, definitely. I mean, you know, there's... I think we find moments, I found moments of real peace and understanding that we kind of don't really ever get where we think we're going to go. And it's okay to rest and enjoy what's here. And it's okay to keep having adventures.
Alicia Dattner is at The Marsh, themarsh.org.